Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Time for our roundtable discussion about Wisconsin wildlife and the great outdoors in our state. Our guest, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor and president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Pat, welcome back.
Thanks, Larry. Happy to be here.
Dean Bortz, the editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, our second guest. And Dean, good to see you as well.
Same here, Larry. Good to be here again.
And Tim Isley, a freelance outdoor writer and private landowner in Crawford County. Tim, by the way, was one of the original founding members of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association back in 1976. And Tim, good to see your face, too.
Thanks, Larry. Wonderful to be here on a beautiful morning, and thank you for the invitation.
We have a lot of topics to talk about, and certainly want you to join in the conversation. So many things to visit about today in terms of our Wisconsin outdoors. Join in at 800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org. Pat, let's start with you. The 9-day deer gun season opens on Saturday in Wisconsin. Lots of excited people, but fewer people, I think, are participating this year than in past years. And there's always speculation about what's driving that reduction. What do you think?
It's the first thing I'd point out is it's not a situation unique to Wisconsin. Actually, Wisconsin has held up better than many states as far as maintaining hunter numbers. But if you go back and 20 years ago, we set records for hunter participation during the gun deer season. We were up around 700,000 people who were buying licenses during the 90s and late and early 2000s. Now we're down below 600,000. And the thing I'd point out, Larry, that you know this as well as anyone, is that this was predicted back in the late 80s by people like Tom Heberlein, you know, looking into the future as far as hunter demographics. And I mean, so often in Wisconsin, you hear everyone you see people pointing fingers saying it's the DNR's fault for this or that. But these are pretty big social trends that we're seeing across the country. And I guess, you know, the one shift we've seen in recent years is much more interest in the last, you know, decade or so by older hunters like basically the four of us picking up the crossbow and hunting earlier in the season and not worrying as much about the gun season because they're getting plenty of activity earlier in the season.
And there's, you know, there's in response to that, there's been some efforts. I know Wisconsin DNR in terms of finding opportunities for young hunters. Dean, you mentioned South Dakota has an opportunity for young hunters that may be different from Wisconsin. Tell us about that.
South Dakota has a $10 junior mentor tag, which is good for an antlerless white-tailed deer. I learned about that because this fall, my daughter asked me if I could take our grandson somewhere this fall when she found out that the youth deer hunt didn't coincide with Eau Claire's October 14th and 15th days off of school. And so she was assuming that we'd be able to do 4 days of hunting in Wisconsin during Mason's time off of school. And when I told her, no, it's, I think it was October 9 and 10, and she said, well, okay, is there any way you can take them out west on the 14th and 15th? I go, well, I don't know, but I'll look. And I found this tag in South Dakota that we could get for $10. And it's $10 for resident or non-resident. And so I ordered him the tag. I also got him a $10 junior mentor small game license. And so we loaded up and headed to Deadwood on a Wednesday night right on the heels of that blizzard that struck that part of the western states. And so on that Thursday, we weren't able to hunt much because we were looking at 2 feet of snow everywhere. But we did go, drove around and found places we could get in on Friday. And we had a great day of hunting. And at the end of the day, he ended up shooting a buck fawn after making a lot of decisions prior to that, you know, throughout the day. You know, he's was, you know, getting used to getting the gun up, looking through it, identifying whether it's a mule deer, whitetail, elk. We saw a herd of elk. We saw bighorn sheep. We saw sharp-tail grouse. And it was, you know, just a great day of hunting. And I guess the thought here would be that if anybody is looking for something to do once they've used up all their Wisconsin tags or even before, they could get this tag in South Dakota. And it was good from, like, I don't think it was September 1st. I think it was, like, September 10th through December 31st. So you have a wide range of options of when to use the tag. And it was a good trip. We had a good time.
Sounds like a fun time for sure. Tim, I want to get you in the discussion. CWD numbers continue to rise. Now there are reports of deer in other states with COVID virus. You think these are two reasons why we need to sample every deer that's taken. Maybe talk a bit about that.
Well, you're right, Larry. I think, and as Pat indicated, the trend has been going downhill. You know, as a lot of us with gray hair are aging and people are dropping out of the hunting community, you know, the trend in numbers has been going downhill, and this was expected. But I think when chronic wasting disease was found in Wisconsin, I think that really put a damper on things. And I know where we were hunting over in Crawford County prior to that. I mean, you'd hear shooting all the time. And afterwards, it was just noticeable that, you know, the shooting had really slacked off. And so I think that just tempers things a little bit. And I think some people are just saying, hey, you know, I just don't want to take the chance, and I'm not going to shoot a deer if it has the chronic wasting disease. And now the new reports that just came out this week about possibly having the COVID in some deer in other states. Now, it says that that has not been found at all in Wisconsin so far, and I think this year, the first year, they're going to be actually testing for that. So, you know, just some of these questions, I think some of the people who are not avid deer hunters, I think maybe they will say, hey, you know, I'm just not going to do it this year.
Yeah.
But in my estimation, if they went back to having deer registered again at the deer registration stations, you bring in your deer, you register your deer, that would give us an opportunity to, number one, sample every deer that's registered. If they had enough.
That would give us an opportunity, number one.
Oh, we.
Also, it's just a good way to get camaraderie. The hunters enjoy talking to each other, you know, comparing notes. And I just think I'd like to go back to that. And I think there'd be a value in checking the health of the herd.
Good points all from you three. Let's take some calls. We've been having a little bit of phone problems getting people online, but keep trying because we have got some people through here. And one of them's Marty in Lake Nabagamon. Marty, what's on your mind?
Well, good morning, you guys. First of all, before I ask my question, I'd like to make it really clear. I am not anti-hunting. My husband was a hunter. I have dear friends who hunt. This isn't the issue. It's about ethical hunting. Do you not think it's time? I'd love your guests' opinions, actually, on this. Isn't it time to halt hunting bear with dogs in Wisconsin? It's been some years, I confess, since I've looked at actual numbers. There was a time when Wisconsin and I think Colorado were the only states in the country that even allowed hunting bear with dogs. And the last time I looked, most of the hunters were from out of state. So what is your opinion on continuing that? And let's get into the wolf hunt. Why not? It's early in the program. What's happening with that? Any updates on that? And thank you guys very much.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, we've got wolves and we got deer to talk. I'm sorry, bear to talk about. Wolves and bear. Who wants to talk about bear? Dean, do you want to chime in there?
Sure, I will. You know, as far as the caller's question about should we end hunting bears with hounds, I'll offer an emphatic no. I understand that a number of people have concerns about it, and I understand why, But no, I mean, I don't own hounds, but I have hunted behind hounds with friends, and all the people that I've been fortunate enough to go with they're good dog handlers, they're good dog trainers, their dogs, you know, I think a lot of people have the impression that these dogs live on the end of chains and they're, you know, razzed to be furious and they go bite bears in the butt, and it's not like that. It's just not. These dogs are well cared for. The people that I know, they love their dogs. They train them. They handle them. They live in the house and on occasion. And when they're in the field, these folks know what they're doing. I mean, I'm just thoroughly impressed with the handling of the hounds that I've seen. And I think that, sure, because of the way our land ownership is structured, there are challenges, no question about it. But the folks that I've gone with have built relationships with the landowners around where they hunt. And there really are no problems. Now, I know problems do exist, but I think we have to leave it up to the individuals with some encouragement to work that all out. So that's where I'm at on that one.
All right. And let's see. Pat, do you want to chime in on the wolf side of things?
What exactly was the question again?
I think there's where are we in terms of the wolf? Wolf hunt. It's so up in the air.
Say we're currently on hold, and I think that's pretty much indefinite. As most people know, we did not have the season we had back in February was not the typical wolf season we have been experiencing. And I still think that was a huge factor in the mess we're in right now. The first three seasons we had back in 2012, 13, and 14, we held a real science-based, science-driven hunt, and that fell apart in this February of 2021. And so I think that just really gave wolf hunting a black eye. And I don't fault the hunters at all for that. I fault our Natural Resources Board for the way they set that thing up. But that could be a whole topic of discussion, you know, for a whole hour or so. I guess I'll leave it there.
We have, as you mentioned the Natural Resources Board, I was talking to somebody the other day, and he said, well, how in the heck can you have a guy refusing to leave his Natural Resources Board seat, even though his date-specific term expired on May 1? And I wasn't in a position to talk about that from a knowledge aspect. How the heck did that happen? Or how does that happen?
Tim's raised. I'm talking. Let Tim go first.
Tim, go ahead.
I think, you know, the thing is that it would have been nice had Dr. Pran
We're losing you, Tim. So let's let Pat pick it up.
It's an interesting discussion. You know, Prane's been, in my opinion, hiding behind this idea that the Supreme Court made it to where a person, if their term expires, basically, they can still sit there until the Senate confirms their replacement. And the thing I pointed out a number of times is that Supreme Court decision was made in 1964, 4 years before we even had a Natural Resources Board with date-specific times. You know, this whole system we have set up right now worked really fine for the first 35 years. We never had anyone overstaying their date-specific time. Now, in the last 20 years, we've had three times come up where twice back in the 2000s, where James Tiefenthaler and Willett, board member Willett, Steve Willett, sat there and waited until their replacements were confirmed. And then Preen came along this year, and he's now 7 months into what I would call squatting on that position. And the thing that the 1968 we had with this new board, the thing that was set up, was date-specific times. Typically, governor appointments, when a new governor takes over, those aren't date-specific. They're basically tied to the governor himself. So I think there's a real legal mess we have here that has not been straightened out. And so I think Dr. Prehn's been taking advantage of that personally.
It's indeed a tough situation all the way around. Jamie in Algoma will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Jamie.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, I had a question. I don't know if your guests would be able to address or not, but I was taking a walk around the harbor in Algoma a couple days ago and happened to notice a pair of mallard ducks mating. And I thought, this is not the right time of year for that. And what's going to happen if she carries those eggs, lays them, and they hatch 21 days or however long the gestation period is? What's going to happen to those poor little ducklings?
Probably won't be good, Dean.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Thanks, Larry. Well, I think we know what's going to happen. They're not going to make it. I guess I've never heard of this before, and whether or not the mating would be viable, I'd be curious about that. That's the first thing I'd want to know. You know, they may just, I don't know if we can say that they were just taking advantage of an opportunity or what, but I guess the first question I'd have would be whether it would actually work and she would become fertilized and begin laying eggs. But if she did, then yeah, they're not going to make it. No. Simple as that.
Pat, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I had a similar thing come up with from a reader last winter, where the guy had some trail cam pictures of wild turkeys that were taken in October of some mating rituals going on, so to speak. And that's the first question you have. Just because there's some odd behavior going on doesn't mean we're actually seeing a fertilization taking place. So chances are nothing happened, but animals do things we don't expect quite often, and so do humans for that matter. But when it comes to mating seasons, yeah, that's definitely way off of the usual timing. But I'd agree with Dean that, you know, I doubt much will come of it one way or another.
Talking about the great outdoors here in Wisconsin, we've taken a look a bit at bear, a little bit at wolves. We've talked about the gun deer season. There's lots we can talk about, and I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. We've had some phone problems, but keep trying. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you're not getting through by phone, you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Tim Isley, Dean Bortz, and Pat Durkin, our outdoor writers. I'm Larry Mueller. Tyler Ditter, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network, taking a look at the great outdoors with Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, freelance writer and editor, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association, and Tim Isley, a freelance outdoor writer. He's a private landowner in Crawford County as well, so he's got a great, nice place in Crawford County. You can join in, but I'm going to explain something to you. We're having some weird phone issues, and when somebody calls in the phone, Tim gets cut off. Tim Isley gets cut off. So what we're going to do is try, we want to hear Tim, so we're going to try this via email for a while until we can get this figured out. So I'm asking you to email us with your questions or comments, and you can email us to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. That's the place to go, and I hope you will email in with your questions. Tim, let's go to you. The possibility of a sandhill crane hunt was brought up recently, and there's been a lot of discussion on that on both sides as to whether or not we should have a hunt for sandhill cranes. What's the status of that?
Right. Well, there was a bill that was brought up, and I understand. I was gone last week, but I understand that they've taken that off the table for right now. I expect it will come back up later on during the next legislative session. But it's a controversial thing, and of course sandhill cranes are migratory, and they have information that they're looking at as far as establishing a season. I just have to say myself personally, I'm against the sandhill crane season. I think sandhill cranes in Wisconsin are so iconic. Aldo Leopold wrote about them in a Sand County Almanac, and I think the sandhill crane is just something that really is very, very special, and it's something that really we don't have to hunt. I know there are people who would like to hunt, but and one of my other my other objections is that this whole thing, and even like with the wolves, this came about through Hunter Nation coming in from out of state, and their spokesperson, the person from Michigan who basically just, they do not speak for me. They do not speak for me. And I think we have to be very careful about our image as hunters. I mean, hunters have got a wonderful background with Ding Darling, Aldo Leopold, Teddy Roosevelt, and the things that hunters have done. But also, we have to be concerned about the non-hunting public and how they view hunters. And I really think that's a concern. I don't see a reason enough to put sandhill cranes on an open season right now, and that's I feel very strongly about that, and especially their spokesperson Ted Nugent. To me, he's just the not the type of person that you want representing hunters, and he does not represent me. So I know that it's controversial, and I know that people are interested in hunting them, but for right now, I believe it's off the table until the next legislative session.
Pat, do you want to chime in as well?
Yeah, I've always been in support of a sandhill crane season. Going back to the year 2000 when we were considering both the mourning dove season and the sandhill crane season, and the mourning dove season eventually got passed. We've now had it for about 20 years, and it's been really quiet. You don't really hear any problems with hunting mourning doves, and I think we'd see the same situation arise with sandhill cranes. That, yeah, it's controversial. I understand we don't have to hunt them. I understand that they are unique, iconic species, but we also, in this state, we hunt lots of wonderful creatures, whether they're white-tailed deer, whether they're Canada geese. They're all sorts of, they're all beautiful creatures that also taste good, and they're fun to hunt. And I guess if I had a chance to hunt sandhill cranes, I'd do it tomorrow. But I just don't think that really hurts hunters' images. I think what hurts the hunters' image is when we do things that go beyond what we're legally entitled to do, and then get arrogant about it and get in people's face about when we get, we don't have to get so defensive sometimes about our hunting practices. I think we do a good job when we just come across level-headed and talk about the good recreational value that deer hunting and these other types of hunting provide hunters and their families.
So there we go. We had a couple of different views on it, and appreciate both of your comments on this. Again, you can join in the email address, ideas@wpr.org. What do you guys think about hunters not needing to attach carcass tags to turkey and deer? Do you think this is causing problems? I mean, I can see problems. I can remember once losing a tag on a deer, and I had to go back and follow my trail back, and I found it, but and I was okay, but I didn't mind at all, really, putting those tags on. Dean, what do you think?
Well, we have a feature in each issue of the newspaper called Cuffs and Collars, where we run down a list of monthly field reports from game wardens across the state. And since this law has changed, or rule has changed, in which we no longer have to register, no longer have to in-person register or put carcass tags on, the number of violations that I see coming across the transom you know, I haven't done a scientific investigation on this or anything like that, but just based on my gut reaction, is like these numbers have increased substantially. And if I check with some of the field wardens, they'll say it's become quite a problem for them. And I guess my question is this having an impact on what we're seeing on the registration end as far as our numbers? You know, we see our Pat and Tim can comment on this. As far as my impression is, our numbers have been down over what the last 5-6 years from what we're used to seeing, and I wonder if this may be playing a role in that.
Tim, you want to chime in?
Well, I think if we went back to having the registration on the animal, I just think to me it would be just less of a chance, you know, of somebody violating the law. And I think we have a better chance of knowing exactly how many of the different species are harvested. So I would like to see us go back to attaching a tag. That's my opinion.
Yeah. Pat, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm really big in favor of mandatory tagging and mandatory in-person registration, whether it's deer, bears, or turkeys. This whole change we had where we dropped the carcass tag requirements was all done in the legislature with no input from the hunting community and definitely no input from the conservation wardens of the state. And the conservation wardens, I mean, you can't basically let law enforcement dictate all our laws. But I think they their field experience should be factored into these kind of decisions. And you know, it's hard to prove a negative. It's hard to prove that people aren't registering their deer as much now because there's no carcass tags. But it would make sense that when we had in-person registration and mandatory tagging, you really were looking over your shoulder to make sure you're squared away before you left the woods, before even after you shot. You know, right away you'd have to start thinking about getting the animal tagged. And if you got excited and started dragging before you tagged it, well, you typically, you know, that little conscience kicking in, and you think about these things and do all the things that the law requires. And right now, in recent years, it's been 4 years now of this almost a Wild West mentality where you just go out and shoot and don't worry about tagging. Don't worry about, you worry about registration, at least it should be. But I think there's that certain little tangible things when you put your hands on a tag, you automatically start thinking then about registration. And then in the days when you had to take it into an actual person and present the deer, and then they come out and tag it with the state's official metal tag, there's a process there that really ingrains the whole principle of registration. I just thought it was a good system. It should not have been messed with. And but again, though, I'd keep reminding people, this is what happens when you don't go through our nice tradition-based procedures in Wisconsin, where the Conservation Congress and the hunters themselves start dictating, you know, basically drive the process. It shouldn't be driven from the top down through the legislature.
And as you're listening in, I hope you'll join it. What are your thoughts on that as you listen to the show? Are you in favor of having those tags back if you're a hunter or even a non-hunter? I hope you'll email us in at ideas@WPR.org, or other questions that you might have as well. The other issue is the back tag. Dean, maybe you want to chime in on that. Is that something that we should have, retained?
I would not be opposed to having it back. A couple of different reasons. The first one I'm going to mention is that we used to have, I guess we still do have the system. It's just not being used because nobody's wearing back tags right now. But we used to have a system for reserved license numbers. And my brother and I, at the time that back tags were discontinued, we were holding a number that as the family members that we were holding them for got older or moved back to Wisconsin, we would have transferred either the grandfather's or the uncle's back tag numbers to the kids as they returned to the state or grew old enough to start hunting. And my brother had number 44 from Herb Schneider, who was a game warden at Stevens Point and then out of Minocqua for many years. And then I had one from my good friend Jim Michaels, who passed away from cancer. And before he died, he transferred the tag to me and asked me to hold on to it until some of his grandkids moved to Wisconsin from Illinois. I'm told that those numbers are still there, and if the back tag is ever resurrected, then I would still have that number. My brother would still have his number. Now, is that a reason enough to bring back a back tag? You know, most people would probably say no, but it was a nice little thing, you know, that we did pay extra for those years to be able to do it. Yeah. Not that was a deal, but And then, you know, just the trespassing thing, I've heard that brought up by a lot of different landowners who say that they wish that hunters still wore back tags so that they could get a back tag number and call it in if they saw somebody trespassing.
Yeah. Pat, you were going to say something too, and maybe yes. Tim as well. Pat, go ahead.
This is where I'm all in favor of carcass tag registration, but I've always been opposed for going back about 30 years. About back tags, my basic argument is that we don't require fishermen, we don't require turkey hunters, we don't require any other hunter to wear a back tag, so why require it for deer hunting? So I guess that's another thing I point out is that I think only one state right now has a back tag, and that, I think that's New Hampshire, one of the eastern states. And Michigan dumped them years ago. Minnesota, I don't think, has ever had them. You go out west, nobody has them. So it's just not something that really you can make a great argument that it's on, that we're not outliers on this. We're in the vast majority of states that do not require back tags.
Yeah. Tim, do you want to chime in?
You bet. Thanks, Larry. Yeah, no, I like back tags. And I think primarily one of the things is from a standpoint of law enforcement, but also dealing with private landowners. I mean, landowners and trespass issues, I think one of the biggest, if you look at probably where some of those instances occur, one of the possibilities is with deer hunting. We've got so many deer hunters, and it's on, and a lot of people are on land, and then you've got neighboring land next door, and it just makes it a lot easier. If there is a problem, it makes it a lot easier to find out who it is and track people down. And I just think it would help in the long run.
Yeah, and Dean, you wanted to chime back in?
I just thought of one other thing. We lost another great tradition with the back tags, and that would have been the annual Friday night throw the tags on the table and see who's got the best poker hand off the numbers in the back tag. I mean, that was a we took a little notch out of the tradition there, and we did away with that.
Okay.
I never did win, by the way. I never won.
Tim Isley, Pat Durkin, Dean Bortz, our guests. Again, you can email in with your comments at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take some emails here. Grace wrote by email. She has hunters on her private property, and some have dumped deer carcasses. And she said the most hunters are pleasant when she talks to them directly, but is doesn't know how to solve this other problem of carcasses being dumped on her property.
Huh.
It's an unusual situation, Pat.
That's one thing I've really enjoyed hearing from readers down in the southwestern Wisconsin area who have put out the dumpsters to collect deer carcasses. The wardens in those areas and everybody else I talked to in those areas say the illegal dumping of carcasses after they've been butchered has gone down dramatically since they started offering these dumpsters. And, you know, the sad thing is, over the years, I mean, most of us who spend much time out in the woods later in deer season and in December, in years past, it wasn't unusual to pull into those public hunting ground parking lots and other public public right-of-ways along roads where you have public land abutting the road and seeing where some idiot dumped his deer carcass there instead of breaking it down a little way and disposing of it properly. And so I don't know where this woman lives and where this problem is occurring, but at least in the areas where we have the dumpsters, to get these CWD, potential CWD deer off the landscape when they're dead. That seems to be helping in cutting down that problem.
I know there are even some hunter groups that have helped to raise the proper funds and so forth to put more dumpsters out.
Right.
Have done quite a job with that. Tim, you were going to chime in too.
Yes, and as Pat indicated, especially down in southwest Wisconsin, there's a gentleman from Richland County who's really been spearheading that. And in Crawford County, I believe it was Andy Novak, who paying their own funds to come up with these dumpsters to put them out. And I think it really that's really a wonderful thing. But we should have more of these dumpsters around the different counties. And I think the lady who had called in would be good to even go to the local towns or the local counties and see if they would come up with some money. We should have more of those dumpsters around, especially with concern over getting rid of the carcass and if it did have chronic wasting disease. So yeah. I think they're a wonderful thing to have, and I think we need to encourage more of them.
Yeah. Dean, you were going to comment.
So I guess to answer the person's question would be to, first, call local law enforcement, whether it be warden or, I guess in this case, it would be the sheriff's department on littering. But then the other option would be to, if you would go through the expense of putting up a trail camera or two, and I would put up, one that I would call the obvious one, and then I would put up a second one where, maybe more obscure, so that they think, aha, I see that trail camera. I'm not going to get caught by that one, but then they get caught on the other one, and then you might have some that you can work on.
We do have callers in. Let's try Frank in Cottage Grove. Frank,
hi. Hey, this is Frank.
Yeah, hi, Frank. What's on your mind?
Well, a couple things. You talk about such ethical hunters. If you want to come out to my place, I can show you holes in my garage, my attached garage, from ethical hunters shooting, trying to shoot deer, but they shot through my garage. And I remember October of 07, my neighbor who was farming my property gave permission to some hunters. There was a four-day gun season. And I was out in my driveway changing oil on my truck. And all of a sudden, shots rang out through my property. And I was crawling on my hands and knees back to my house, fearing I was going to get shot. I didn't even know that these guys are out there.
Well, that's the kind of thing, Pat, I'll just let you comment. Go ahead.
Yeah, and these kind of, I never would diminish the fear that this man experienced. That had to be a terrible experience to live through. On the plus side, though, if you look at hunter safety in Wisconsin, we have done a remarkable job the last three decades of pretty much bringing down fatalities during the gun deer season to where now I think it was like seven of the last 10 years, we've had no fatalities during the gun deer season. So, we've done a much better job of, we don't do deer drives as much as we used to, which used to cause a lot of these shooting accidents we had. And so, if you go back in history, back in the 50s, we were averaging 8 gun deer fatalities every year during the deer season in November. And in recent years, we're below 1. For the last decade, we're actually like at 0.75 on an average for fatalities during gun deer season. So these things do happen, though, but I'd still say that the kind of cases he's talking about are still much more akin to a lightning strike than they are to a day-to-day risk.
Of being shot. Tim,
right.
Tim Isley, Pat Durkin, Dean Bortz, our guest today, talking about the world of wildlife. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. taking a look at the great outdoors in Wisconsin with our Wildlife Roundtable discussants, Tim Isley, freelance outdoor writer, Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News, Pat Durkin, editor, writer, and president of Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. Our lines are fixed and they're all full, so it's nice to know. If you want the number, it's 800-642-1234, and we have emails as well at ideas@wpr.org. Rose in Menominee Falls has a question for you guys. Rose, thank
you. Hello there.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Okay, I hope you can bear with me. I live in a subdivision, and there's a village park right adjacent to it, with a big pond with a path around it. And then on the other side of the path, there's a bunch of trees, and then the Menominee River runs parallel with this pond. And I have lived here for 26 years, and we have never had beaver in this area. And recently, starting this summer, they are completely decimating all of the trees that are along the pond edge, and they fall into the water, and we don't know, are they building a dam somewhere? If it's over on the river, why would they be cutting down the tree adjacent to the pond, or do they eat the trees under the water, or what is going on with these beaver? But the big question is, they are completely decimating the trees, and mostly maples.
Hmm. Well, who wants to take that, Dean? Go to you, Dean Bortz.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess I'll start with the one question about whether they're building a dam. Probably not. You know, there are they'll live in bank dens as well. So they don't have to build a dam. They can live in bank dens. And so they're probably living on the edge of that pond or on the river somewhere. And then, you know, of course, they're cutting the trees down for their food, and they'll store the branches from those trees under the water for winter food, their winter food cache under the ice. And I guess it's interesting to hear that there are beavers active that far south in Wisconsin. I would have been, that surprises me.
Hmm. Interesting. Tim, chime in.
I think I would encourage her to check with the local community and municipality and find out the rules, but then it might be worth checking with the Wisconsin Trappers Association if it would be possible to have a trapper come in and if the beavers are continually cutting down all the trees, it may be a decision. Do you want the beavers or do you want the trees? So I think the Trappers Association normally would like to help out on something like that.
But you should probably talk to the municipality first. Yeah, right. Yeah, you're nodding yes. There you go, Rose. I'd give a call to the to your local municipality and see what they have to say about it, because it doesn't seem to. I mean, if they're taking them all down, and it's a park, that may not be something that they want either. Dean.
Larry, I just was hoping we could go back to the caller, Frank from Cottage Grove, who called in just before the break. The one last thought I'd have on that is I heard him mention that he leased his property to a neighbor to farm, and that person granted permission to somebody that he wasn't aware of. I guess I'd just suggest, and maybe they already have this in place, that if anybody's granted permission, it probably should be the landowner, or if he's going to allow the leasor to give permission, then that information should come back to Frank so that he knows who's there, how many, when, and all of that stuff. That's just one recommendation.
Yeah, and a good one at that. Let's go to Jeff in Spider Lake. Hi, Jeff.
How are you doing there?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I try and stay informed on conservation issues, and I regularly read things written by all three of your guests. And we can talk about all sorts of stuff, back tags and crane hunts and things like that, but I have never been more concerned about the future of our traditions and natural resources than I am right now. The DNR and the NRB are at odds. The legislature has taken on natural resources issues, taken the lead on them. Pseudo-conservation groups from out of state are weighing in. this is, is it just me? I mean, our tradition of conservationists working together seems to be falling apart. I mean, is it me or is this really what's going on? Because I think it's a big deal.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate the comment. The DNR and the NRB and legislators need to get back on the same page, I think, is what Jeff's saying. But let's get some comments from our guests. Dean, start with you. Dean Boards.
Well, I couldn't agree more with the caller. I mean, he's right. I mean, there's it's an unusual landscape that we're looking at these days. I mean, there's nobody working with anybody here. Everybody wants their own little kingdom and stomping on everybody else to get it. You know, how do we get back to that? I'd welcome any suggestions or hearing some ideas from Tim and Pat or anybody else, any callers even. But I think we'd have to start, I would suggest we need leadership out of the governor's office, and somebody has to just say, let's knock it off. Here's how it's going to go. Let's get to work. We've got to have some leadership somewhere.
Yeah. Pat, you're going to chime in, and Tim. Sure, Pat, go first.
Okay. I share the man's concern. I'm not old enough to remember back in the early 90s when the legislature was floating an idea of basically making the 9-day gun deer season state law that can never deviate from 9 days. And I remember the Wisconsin Conservation Congress sending down some of their top people to testify against that and pointing out that the whole reason we have the Congress is to have them take the lead in these things and then bring that stuff up from the bottom and not have the legislature cutting in and basically short-circuiting things. And I guess when I watched things happening this year and this recent introduction of 13 bills straight from the legislature into real basic nuts and bolts of our gun, of our various hunting seasons and stuff, all I could think was I didn't like it, but I also didn't like the fact that we heard very little pushback publicly. I mean, about, you know, from the people who are losing their rights on this. I thought the Conservation Congress, I thought everyone involved in our system here should be pushing back vocally on this, not just sitting back and basically saying tisk tisk, but not really getting mad about it. I just felt like you're stepping on these people's turf and they're not taking it personally. I guess I don't understand why some of the folks in the Congress and elsewhere in our hierarchy here aren't taking that more personally and getting involved. I mean, I can't really, I'm not surprised the governor hasn't stepped up, because the governor, frankly, you know, he's not a hunter. He's never been a hunter. He doesn't pretend to be a hunter. And so I'm not surprised that he hasn't said anything on this, because I don't think he really understands these kind of issues and why they matter to us. I think hunters themselves have got to be more vocal on this.
Tim, a comment?
You bet. Thanks, Larry. Yes, I definitely agree with the caller, Jeff. You know, back in the early 1900s, what was happening was that the legislature was passing all sorts of laws on natural resources, and they were doing things because of people who had donated money to them or their friends who said, well, we ought to have this type of a deer season or that type of a deer season. And basically, that was the reason that some of our conservation leaders back in the 1920s came up with the idea that what we needed was a conservation commission, and then we formed the state conservation department. So that was where the natural resource regulations and were supposed to come from, and then they would come up with it based on professionals that they hire. Well, we've gone along, and all of a sudden things have gone topsy-turvy. We're seeing now the legislature passing these laws coming from the top down, and a lot of which are very questionable and don't make sense. I mean, I think, number one, the governor needs to step up and needs to put things back in order. One of the best ideas I heard was from a fellow by the name of Peter Peschuk, who said, you know, back when they put together all these organizations to come up with the state agencies to come up with the DNR, it was because they had a Kellett Commission. We need a Kellett Commission, too, right now. Basically, and sportsmen and women should be promoting something like that, to put, get somebody to come together with some recommendations to try and put things back in order, because between the DNR, the Natural Resources Board, the legislature, things are just falling between the chairs, and we need something to set things right again.
Well, I appreciate all of your thoughts on this, and we'll get more of your thoughts, I'm sure, as we move along, and we have lots of callers. Jeff and Spider Lake, thank you so much for bringing this up. Others, callers may want to chime in on that same topic. But our guests will be with us right up until 12:30. Tim Isley, freelance outdoor writer. Dean Bortz, editor of Wisconsin Outdoor News. And Pat Durkin, freelance writer, president of the Wisconsin Outdoor Communicators Association. We are going to take a quick look at the news. We'll find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our three guests. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at our wildlife outdoor writers. Dean Bortz, Tim Isley, oh my gosh, and Pat Durkin. And we're talking, this is our roundtable. We have these guys come and visit with us a few times a year at various points, and this seemed like a really good time to have them here. And lots of good conversation, good questions for them. You can call at 800-642-1234 with your own thoughts, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Brian in Greene County has a question. Let's go there. Brian, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Just curious why the double standard on carcass disposal. Years ago, the county workers and the state patrolmen and such would dispose of deer carcasses that were hid alongside the road. And in recent years, they're just left to decompose. So how is it acceptable for those carcasses to be left, and yet hunters need to dispose of theirs properly? Is it strictly a funding issue, or what's behind it?
All right. Dean, do you want to take a crack?
Yeah, sure. I used to cover county boards back in the day, and I don't know that if this is still part of that or not, but even back then, so, you know, 25, 7, 8 years ago, funding was the big reason for, and maybe a little bit of a kingdom battle too, you know, highway departments not wanting to do it, police departments not thinking they should do it, but a lot of it did go back to funding, they figured, well, you know, natural process, let them, you know, just disappear alongside the highway. And I think it's still a carryover from that, and it hasn't been connected to the question that the caller just brought in.
Yeah, that makes, and probably should be, though.
Yeah, probably so.
Yeah. There you go, Brian. I appreciate your call. Let's go to Barnes, Wisconsin, an area I know pretty well, and Teddy from Barnes has something for us. Hi, Teddy.
Hey, Larry. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, I got a great big red bull on a 10-pointer up by your cabin. If you want to come up, you can see him easy then. So.
Okay.
But going way back to back tags, I'm for them. One is accountability for everyone. Peace of mind for the homeowners and landowners and stuff like that, and accountability for the hunter. Also, I have all my back tags. My kids do. And when you take away something physical, a physical item that you can't collect and talk about, and like before opener, we used to sit and go through all of them. I mean, I'm 61. I could tell my kids, like, I was 12, 13, you know, I shot this, I shot that. And you really lose a big part of camp and a big part of bonding and communication. And then, of course, the before mentioned annual poker game, you know. So Just my thought, but I think it's a cool thing that should come back.
All right. Teddy, thank you so much for calling. Tim, you were going to make a comment.
Well, I agree, and I think the fact that he indicated something physical like that, and it brings you back to past hunts and something that you can enjoy and relive. And I know I once interviewed a hunter who basically they had a camp log, and I think probably it's pretty typical of a lot of different camps, and they have a camp log where they would write down, you know, who got what and what they saw, and somebody saw a fox or whatever, somebody got the biggest deer. And then every year, the night before the deer season, Friday night, the ritual was the reading of the log. So they'd go back through it, and they'd go back, and they'd read all of the different hunts, and when different people and somebody did something stupid, you know, and everybody laughed or whatever. But it just, it's a part of the camaraderie of the hunt and enjoying it and sharing it. And I think back tags have some history. And it's sort of similar to the federal duck stamp. Those of us who are waterfowl hunters collect our federal duck stamps, and many of them are framed. And the back tags are sort of a little bit similar to that.
Thank you very much, Teddy, for calling in for that comment on the buck as well. Appreciate that information, too. Jeffrey wrote by email, it's wondering about the expansion of species that can be hunted by air rifles. He's wondering about bigger game like turkey or deer. If more animals could be hunted by air rifles, would this open up hunting opportunities for people who didn't grow up around firearms in particular?
I guess I know they're making some incredible advances with air rifles, but I don't know that we really have taken a real serious look at what their capabilities are. And I mean, I guess the one thing that pops into my mind is we already argue a lot about calibers of rifles and other things, and like you mentioned in your intro, copper bullets. And I guess I'm more interested in getting people to go out and start shooting copper bullets more often and make it their standard ammo than, I guess, trying to worry about air rifles. I suppose that one advantage would be that there's no recoil and not as much noise, or at least very little recoil from that. But I just haven't, in my work, I've not come across many people who were really too worried about missing out on something by not using air rifles.
You mentioned the copper bullets, and Dan Small was with us last week Wednesday, for his Deer Hunt 2021. And I don't know if you guys have seen that video yet, his show yet, but it's quite good. And one part of it had to do with copper bullets. And you could see the difference when those bullets were shot into a liquid of some sort, and then the lead bullets were shot into a standard, similar kind of liquid, that the amount of spread of fragments so much greater.
Mm-hmm.
In the lead bullets versus the copper, which it just makes perfect sense as far as I'm concerned. Tim, you're nodding in agreement there.
You bet. I've seen those same demonstrations, and way back years ago, I believe it was Chris Parrish with the Peregrine Fund who put that on back at an outdoor writers seminar out in North Dakota back in 2008, and saw it for the first time then. And then in Wisconsin several years ago, Carl Batha, one of the DNR wildlife biologists, picked it up and did the same thing here in Wisconsin and showed it, which Chris did then this year, and that's what Dan was, I think, reporting on. But you see they line up like milk gallon containers filled with water, and then they shoot into that, and then you look at the different containers after they empty the water out and see what is left. And there are lead fragments in there, and lead will fragment. And so, number one, the concern is that if when people gut out their deer and then the offal, they leave it in the woods, and if there's lead bullets or fragments in that, and then you have like bald eagles that come down and eat it, that some of them will get lead poisoning. Number two, the concern is that there are also lead fragments in the venison that you're feeding your family. And the difference between then, you see them do that same comparison with copper bullets, and it's very convincing. And I switched over to copper bullets myself, and I think it just makes loads of sense. It really does make a lot of sense. And I'd like to see us switch away from lead for all of our hunting, to be honest with you.
I think, I would put in a plug for Dan Small's Deer Hunt 2021. If you haven't seen that video, it's up and available in many places. And that's a very striking, if you haven't seen that experiment done before, it's really worth taking a look at the video, not only for that, but for the rest of the information that Dan's got in that video. It's a really, really well done. Rick in Gays Mills, let's go to you. Rick, hi.
Hi. Can you guys characterize for me what the, the controversy is? The caller who called about things not being like it was historically. I'm not a hunter, but I have a farm where people hunt, and I don't understand or have any idea what the controversies are about. If you could characterize them, I'd appreciate it.
And you're talking about when we were talking about the DNR and the other organ, the legislature and that sort of thing. Is that what you were referring to, Rick?
Yes, please. Because I don't know what the controversies are, and would be curious to understand it better, please.
Okay. Let's see. Dean, let's go to you.
Well, this could actually probably take book length, so we'll try to avoid that. But Pat and Tim, I think we're in what, our 86th or 87th year of having a process, sort of the Conservation Congress and a board of some, a citizen board of some sort, setting policy for our agency, our Natural Resource Agency, which back in the day was the Wisconsin Conservation Department, and now it has evolved into the DNR. And so the premise being that a lot of our hunting, fishing, trapping, public land management, forestry rule changes come from the public, come from the grassroots. Or if it comes from some other place, the ideas are generated somewhere else, it comes through this process where we have the Conservation Congress consists of 5 delegates from each of our 72 counties come together several times a year to work through this whole thing. We have the spring hearings the second Monday of April, and at the spring hearings we vote on any of these proposals. So all of this work is done below the level of the legislature, and all the hunters, fishermen, and trappers get to talk it all out, figure out what all the concerns might be, address the concerns, polish the policy or the proposed rule, and then send it up to where all the legislators have to do is basically once it's voted on at our level, say, okay, it's all been worked on, put it on through. I guess that'd be, and now it's sort of happening in another way. So I guess that's sort of the short of it. Maybe the other two gentlemen can add to that.
Sure. Tim?
Sure. Well, so now we've got a lot of the regulations that are being started by the legislature with no input, basically, from the Department of Natural Resources or other conservation organizations, even the nonprofit conservation organizations, which have got a lot of people who care about natural resources. The other thing is that we have a Department of Natural Resources and a Natural Resources Board that used to at least function together. The DNR will come up with recommendations, and they will put them through the Natural Resources Board. The DNR is coming up with information which basically is should be based on science from wildlife managers, fisheries managers, researchers. So that information is going to the Natural Resources Board, and the Natural Resources Board is sort of where your social science comes in. They are 7 citizens from around the state, and they will then adopt or approve or change the regulations, and that's the way it's always functioned. And now you've got the Department of Natural Resources actually refused to take a decision by the Natural Resources Board and follow that, and then you've got problems between the Natural Resources Board and the DNR, and so the whole thing is just sort of a deck of cards, and it seems to be falling apart.
Yeah. And Pat, to wind it up?
Yeah, I'll say real quickly, the one thing that's changed a lot in the last 10 years is typically the process when it got to the board level was that the board would weigh in on DNR advice. The DNR would make its proposal. This is what they recommend. Then the board would vote on that. And these days, what you're seeing so often is kind of the opposite, where the board is bringing up its own ideas, then ramming them through because they right now have a 4-vote majority. So you're not seeing them actually voting on DNR proposals. They're kind of dictating what's going to be talked about. It's kind of it's gone backward. And this all, Larry, you know, these things happen. They don't happen all at once. They happen gradually over the years. And I always say all you have to do is go back. We started this Natural Resource Board program in 1968, where the governor appointed the board members, and the board members appoint the Natural Resource Secretary. In 1995, that was done away with. The governor still appoints the board members, but now the governor appoints the DNR Secretary. And starting from that point on, you can just watch the steady downward mess we created by allowing this to happen and not stopping it when we had a chance. And to go back and start over again now, it's going to get a big, big groundswell that right now I frankly don't see it happening.
Yeah, there's not going to be a governor. I don't care if it's Democrat or Republican or whatever, who's going to want to not have the ability to pick that
right.
that person anymore.
Right.
For sure. Well, on another note, Dylan wrote in by email and wants to know about the Wisconsin elk hunt. Interested in how it actually went last year. What is the size of the current elk herd, and how far away are we from an over-the-counter hunt, perhaps, like you might have with turkey or deer or what have you? Well, and not so much with turkey, but with deer anyway.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I doubt we'll see it in our lifetime, over-the-counter. Where we have a better chance of it happening would be in the newer herd down around Black River Falls, where you're starting to see more animals showing up and more problems with property and destruction stuff. But as far as that herd up in the Clam Lake area, if it ever gets beyond where we're at right now, it's going to be a very, very slow process.
Yeah, and they do roam around a little bit. Tim, there was there an elk, a bull elk in your area, or I guess maybe even south of you?
There was in Richland County. I know I saw some photos just a year ago where there was a bull elk down there, and I think most of these are young bulls that are roaming out looking for females, and so they can go out quite a ways. And that second herd around Black River Falls is, of course, the newest one, and that's expanding. And I've heard at the Natural Resources Board meetings, there have been farmers, cranberry farmers, and other farmers from around that Black River Falls area that are very concerned as far as potential crop damage from the elk. So yeah, I think it's going to be a while before there would be anything with being able to just buy a license and hunt over the counter. I think they'll have tags for quite a few years yet.
Yeah. Patricia in Portage, let's go to you. Thank you for calling. Patricia, are you there?
I am. Hello.
Hi. What's on your mind?
Yeah. I think it's time in a extinction of half of life on Earth, wildlife, with only 4% of mammals on Earth wild and the rest of it livestock and us, that the system be changed to include the 90% of us who don't kill wildlife. All I hear ever is media for outdoors killing on our public lands. We all buy our public lands, billions of dollars of public lands, and they're all prioritized to killing the last wildlife, farming it to deer and turkey and elk and whatever hunters want to kill, and trapping must be ended. now, or we're not going to have any life in this planet, and we're going to have more pandemics, more chronic wasting disease with an inflated 1.8 million deer, less natural carnivores because they like to trophy kill everything that is bigger.
Well, I'm going to break in there on you, Pat, because I think we've got your message, and I want to give our guys a chance to respond. Tim, go to you.
Sure. I disagree with Patricia. I'm afraid I think in the past, the hunters and fishermen and trappers, basically through the licenses and through their work, have advocated for good management, and management based on science. And that's the most important thing. But really, what we need to have people get together between the hunters and the non-hunters and come together to support the good conservation programs in this state. And, of course, Wisconsin is really special. We have had conservation leaders. You take a look at the people in the Wisconsin Conservation Hall of Fame. This state is very special because it has had people who really live and die with natural resources, and we've been very fortunate because of that. So we need both groups. I mean, people can be non-hunters. They can be just as passionate about natural resources. You look at the Madison Audubon Society. You look at all these other groups, a lot of people who are non-hunters, and they're right out there working on behalf of wildlife. So we need both of them to work together. That's what we need.
Yeah. Comment from Pat or Dean?
Yeah. Dean? Go ahead, Dean.
Oh, I was just going to say I'm glad Tim took that one first because I'm not as tactful as Tim.
Well, Pat, what about you? Do you have a comment?
Well, Tim makes a good point. I guess I wish when folks are so anti-hunting, they would at least come into it with the idea that we can probably find some middle ground here. And a lot of times I'll hear folks like Pat making these comments, and there's some kernels of truth in some of her comments, but then we go into this thing where you start ascribing motive to hunters and why we hunt and why we trap and that we're just after trophies and all this kind of stuff. I think you're then you're just kind of stereotyping hunters and what are and making us all one evil person that we are not. And in our country, we have a strong, strong, proud history of conservation. You know, and in a lot of these public lands that Pat was mentioning, it's because of people like Teddy Roosevelt, who was a serious hunter himself. And then down to the history, we've done a good job.
Well, on that note, Tim Eisley, Dean Boards, Pat Durkin, thank you once again for being with us. And in a few months, I hope we'll be back and we can do this all over again. Oh, man.
It's always fun, Larry.
Thank you guys very much for being with us today. And thank you for listening in. Tomorrow we'll be taking a look at a new PBS Wisconsin program on the history of shipwrecks in the Great Lakes. A great video out on that. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store. I'm Larry Mueller.